college campus, I think.
I've been there long enough.
That's right.
Yeah, I know what they look like now.
How long you been at UC Davis? Just give my ears, somebody give me the high hole.
I think we're gonna get started. On behalf of the Science Coalition, welcome everyone. My name's Chris Harrington, I'm with the University of California System here in Washington. We're pleased to have all of our PCAS award winners with us today. Quick note about the Science Coalition. The Science Coalition is a group of 50 public research universities across the country that advocate on behalf of basic research. You probably picked up a Sparking Economic Growth Report when you walked in. It's one of our products. So we're really looking forward to today's discussion. You can learn more about the Science Coalition online at sciencecoalition.org. Thanks to everyone for being here. John?
Thanks, Chris. Good afternoon and welcome to this roundtable discussion sponsored by the Science Coalition, and thank you all for coming through the rain today. My name is John Fury and I will be the moderator. We are gathered at the National Press Club to hear from 10 researchers who are rising stars in their respective fields of study. They are members of the 2013 class of PCAS winners. The PCAS Award, or Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, is the highest honor our nation bestows upon scientists in the early stages of their independent research career. The award embodies the highest priority placed by the government on maintaining this leadership position of the United States in science by producing outstanding scientists and engineers and nurturing their continued development. They are the all-Americans of science. Our panelists are in Washington this week to be recognized by President Obama and the heads of America's science agencies. We are honored to have all of you here, and let me personally congratulate each one of you for this most prestigious recognition. Before we start, let's go around the table very quickly. I'd like each of you to introduce yourselves briefly. Tell us what you do for a living, tell us about your work, and give us the cocktail version of your career. And we'll start with Dr. Priestley.
Sure. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rod Priestley. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at Princeton University. I've been there since 2009. I'm an experimental polymer scientist. I develop experimental techniques to characterize the mechanical and thermal properties of polymers at the nanoscale, more specifically trying to address several questions. That is, does the properties of polymers change when you confine them to the nanoscale? If so, then why? And then how can we use that knowledge to engineer materials from the bottom up with pre-described properties?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mona Jarahi from University of California, Los Angeles. I recently moved my lab from University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. So I work on electronic and optoelectronic devices which operate at terahertz frequencies. These are frequencies at which most chemicals have very unique spectral signatures, and most optically opaque materials are transparent. And as a result, it enables a very unique platform for new functionalities in imaging and sensing.
Hello, my name is Andy Goodman. I'm assistant professor in the Department of Microbial Pathogenesis and the Microbial Diversity Institute at Yale University. I am a microbiologist. I'm interested in the enormous populations of beneficial bacteria that we all carry, 10 times more cells than our own cells. My lab is asking two questions. The first is, how does this these communities form? How do these bacteria talk to each other? The second is, does the variation in these communities impact what happens when we take medicine?
Hi, I'm Tim Beardsley, and I'm not an early career scientist. I'm the editor-in-chief of Bioscience, which is the monthly journal of the American Institute of Biological Sciences. I've worked in the past for Nature, for Scientific American as a writer and editor. Now I occasionally write editorials and oversee an editorial board that selects manuscripts to publish on the general theme of integrating the life sciences.
Uh, Hello, my name is Jennifer Reed. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm also a project lead in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. My group is interested in developing computational models and applying systems biology tools to study and engineer microbes. In particular, we're looking at engineering microbes for biofuel production as well as production of value-added chemicals.
I'm Jeff Mervis. I'm a senior correspondent at Science Magazine.
Short and sweet. Hi, I'm Lane Martin. I'm an associate professor of material science and engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And I guess I would consider myself to kind of be like a materials innovator. I try to make materials do things they can't do in nature. And so we do this by growing thin films of these materials and kind of pushing and pulling and squeezing on these materials to create new properties and functionalities that can be used to kind of drive next generation devices.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Catherine Rowan, and I'm from the University of California School System at Davis. I'm a recent transfer from UCSF, where I do research in both the clinical arena and in the basic science arena. So I run a rhesopathy clinic where we see patients, a clinic that I actually started in 2007. We see patients with rhesopathy and try to provide them with the best medical practice. And I also have a basic science laboratory where I study muscle development on the rhesopathies and fuse the two together in, again, truly a clinical translational field.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Pillow. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm in the Department of Psychology and the Departments of Neuroscience and Statistics, and so I'm what's often called a theoretical neuroscientist, so I collaborate very closely with experimental neuroscientists to try to figure out how the brain works at a large scale. And so in detail, what that means is we study the activity of neurons in different parts of the brain, try to figure out how it is that their activity is able to bring about all the mental functions that we have, vision, perception, memory, the ability to control our arms. All of this, we can think about the brain as a sort of fancy computer that we don't really know how its components work. And so we're trying to figure out through mathematical modeling and statistical analysis of neural data how it is that the brain is able to do what it does.
Shout out to all of that. But I'm a reporter for the Medill News Service. We are affiliated with Northwestern University, but we cover stories for USAtoday.com and various other partners. I'm specifically focused on the health and science beat.
Hello, everybody. I am Ana Maria Rey. I am associate research associate professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder and a GILA fellow. I am a theorist. I am an atomic physicist. I work in the interface between atomic physics and quantum matter. And what we want to do is use ultra-cold atoms, atoms cooled down to a 1/1,000,000,000th of a Kelvin, in order to mimic the behavior of electrons in solid-state systems. And the idea is to use these atoms that are highly controllable to emulate solid-state materials and address questions that we don't know yet, like a holy grail is, for example, the root of high-temperature superconductivity. And in addition, we use these atoms also for precision measurements, clocks, and in principle also for quantum information.
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Karen Kaplan. I'm the editor of Nature Magazine's career section. So as you might guess, we cover careers issues for early career scientists, largely these days focusing on science budgets around the world, federal spending, where the grants are, and where the jobs are.
I'm Brian Anderson. I'm an associate professor in the GE Plastics Materials Engineering professor at West Virginia University. And in my research group, we focus on energy systems, characterizing energy systems using modeling and experimental techniques from the molecular level, actually all the way to the national energy deployment scale with economic models. I'm also a Resident Institute Fellow at the National Energy Technology Lab, and I'm the coordinator of energy research programs at West Virginia University, where we're putting together a comprehensive portfolio of energy research.
I'm Sam Stein. I'm soaking wet from outside. so excuse this odor that's coming from my jacket. I'm not a scientist. I'm a reporter with the Huffington Post. And what brings me here, beyond my love for John, is I cover sequestration and the impact that it's having on both science research and medical research.
I'll report that he doesn't smell that bad. Hi, I'm Dr. Samantha Hansen. I'm an assistant professor in the Geological Sciences Department at the University of Alabama. I'm an earthquake seismologist, so I use signals from earthquakes around the world to image subsurface structure of the globe. Most recently, I've been working in Antarctica, and so the project associated with my PCAS award is focused on the Transantarctic Mountains.
Well, I appreciate you all being here today. This is very exciting for all of us. I'm going to start the questions, and then we have some journalists here who are going to step in as well. I'm going to steal Sam Stein's question first, though, to get him interested in this discussion. Dr. Martin, we talked a little bit earlier about sequester horror stories. And we might as well just start with that, because I'm sure you all have some. We'll start with you, and if you have any especially good ones, please raise your hand, and we'll start with you.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the people in this room have probably been pretty successful, but even I think for us, it's been a hard time. And so I've had, just in the recent last year, proposals that have scored perfects at certain agencies, you know, 3 out of 3 perfect scores, highly recommended for funding. And in the end, they sit on them 6 months after everyone else has been rejected, then we find out. And so it's really difficult to kind of hire new students, keep students consistently working on an exciting and new program and doing all these sorts of things. I've seen concern with raising funds for, you know, the infrastructure, you know, the hardware to do the science. Our work is it requires this infrastructure to really do the cutting edge stuff. And so I think all of these things are coming together to make it really stressful as a young scientist in the field to keep things moving forward and really keep that momentum going.
Dr. Reed, you want to chime in? When you nod your head like that, you're going to get called.
I'd like to add, you know, I think our students see us struggle with this as well. And I think, in particular, I think we're not discouraging them, but it's very discouraging for them to want to pursue an academic career and to pursue kind of research endeavors, and when they see how difficult it is. And so I think the funding has had an impact in terms of keeping the new generation of, I mean, they're not that younger than me, but the new generation of
Dr. Priestley, you want to raise your hand, but I'm going to put an additional question to you. Research. We were talking earlier about the polymers you're working on. I don't know much about polymers, but I do know that this does have some impact on how we get energy production. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the sequester stories and then the value proposition that comes from your research.
Sure. I did have one comment about funding, and I think us as junior faculty, we're somewhat shielded from it, or hopefully we are, by these agencies and our program managers. But what is still true, even if we are shielded, is the amount of excellent proposals that go unfunded for each call. For instance, if I can recall the DOE career proposal, I think the first year that it came out, I think the funding was somewhere around 6% out of 1,000 proposals. And so that just tells you the number of really good proposals that went unfunded. And I think that's something we should think about. With respect to my own research and the value for doing fundamental work, and so I'm in polymer science, and one, I say, can view it in this manner. Nearly every advancement in every field is driven by advances in material science and engineering. For instance, the new Boeing 787 aircraft is 70% composite. Before we could make that plane out of 70% composites, we had to be able to understand the material at all different length scales, from the macro scale in which you view the plane, but then also at the nano scale. And so in my group, we actually characterize the properties of materials at the nano scale from a fundamental perspective to predict their long-term performance. And so I would view materials research as being in line with the advancement of any field, whether or not you're in battery technology or medicine, for instance. Most advancements are made in connection with an advancement in a material.
Sam Stein, I'm going to ask you to ask a question because I told you I was going to do that, and here you are.
Well, one of the things that I've come across, and I think was hinted in these conversations, was what's known in non-scientific terms as brain drain. And you're all young scientists, and like you said, Dr. Pitsley, you've been relatively immune from the budget cuts. But I'm wondering if any of you have stories of colleagues or students or contemporaries who've considered either leaving the field or considered going abroad to countries that are investing more money in scientific research they're not investing more than we are, but are showing more of a commitment to investing in scientific research.
We're going to give that to Dr. Goodman.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a general perception that things are very hard. And I'm not sure my perspective is the same, that we're shielded from the challenges. We're often told, well, you're lucky to be a new investigator now because things will be really bad later. But that's not very, very, you can't really plan research around that kind of shielding. I don't feel shielded in that way. As far as colleagues whose work, I think I know more about the colleagues whose work has been funded in basic research. I think that's a real strength of what federal research is providing, is we have a very, I think, much better track record at basic research leading to advances that is very important to protect. And I can think of a colleague who is studying how bacteria talk to their viruses, which seems totally obscure. In the last 6 months, it's become a major tool for manipulating genomes, for all kinds of research. So I think that the strength of what happens is the degree to which basic research is funded. The people whose work has not been funded, I think they just sort of disappear. So we sort of, their website's gone, and they don't come to the meetings, and that's kind of at least the last I hear about it.
Can I just follow up on that? Because it would seem that common sense would dictate that in a tough funding climate, a scientist putting together a proposal would gear his or her proposal around something that was either very flashy to get attention or something that the market demanded, research that had a clear use at that point in time and not exploratory research, so to speak. I'm wondering if anyone here feels like that's the trend that we're taking.
So we're going to give that to Dr. Anderson.
Yes, Sam, that's a great point. I think that academic research and research in general is a continuum all the way from the applied into the basic. And along that continuum, if it's the applied research, it might have a use tomorrow. The basic research, and I think that's where a lot of the value added, back to the even previous question, a lot of the value added in the basic research is being able to look forward 30 years from now for a technology. And I can give you an example within energy technologies. We have this shale gas boom that's going on right now in the United States. If you back up 30 years, the technology that's being used today was developed using federal funds at a national lab in the United States. And so that's the role of federal research funding, is to be able to look forward 30 years. And within that specific sector, I do have a colleague who has just recently taken a faculty position in Europe in an environment where he's working in energy technologies, looking at a technology that's 30 years out and has access to a much more favorable funding environment for that basic research that's looking 30 years out than he does in the United States right now.
Dr. Ron, you want to address that?
Yes, and just to springboard off of a melding of these two questions here, is there over the last decade been a big push for medical doctors to go into research, into clinical translational research? And speaking as both as a medical doctor and a PhD and doing them both, what I'm seeing that's happening is we spend a lot of money and time doing both an MD and a PhD, and what we're seeing in the University of California system is having these individuals, after struggling with funding, go into private industry. And so this is exactly, you know, the field and the direction that we don't want them to go. We want them to stay in academic medicine. We want them to stay into clinical translational research to provide the best practices for patients in the future. And this is a very common scenario right now.
Dr. Pillow, did you want to jump in on that?
I was just going to chime in on this idea about the research the funding climate in the U.S. and how that's affecting the perspective for young people entering the field or even established scientists. I certainly have. I was going to say, first of all, I think for many years the United States has benefited from a kind of reverse brain drain, which is that the best and brightest from all other countries would come to the United States to do research, and because we have for a very long time had the most generous support for the basic scientists, and it's been a place where you had the most academic freedom and the best resources. And so it's I feel, you know, when I look around at my colleagues, they're very international. They're mostly you know, at least more than half of them, I'd say, were born elsewhere. And so it's great that we've benefited from that for so long. But I have seen, especially recently, a trend that's starting to reverse a bit. And so several of my colleagues have moved to Europe. I know the Japanese government has started to support neuroscience research at a very high level. I considered a position in Switzerland earlier this year. The Swiss government has a different kind of system where they guarantee funding for scientists. So that they guarantee them a certain number of postdoctoral positions that they can. So they have. They invest in people is the sort of philosophy that this particular Swiss program was trying to put forth, and so it is certainly appealing in this kind of uncertain climate to think, well, I have a grant now, but in 5 years, you know, given the way things are going, will I still be able to run my lab? And so I think we have to take a serious look at the level of funding and also at the kinds of programs we have in place to make scientists want to do science here.
Why didn't you go?
I did not.
Why did you not go?
Oh, I guess many reasons, but I mean, I have fantastic collaborators here. Things are not so dire. I really do believe that even in this climate that I will be able to, that the work we're doing is something that's directed in a way that the government will continue to support it. That
he likes Texas, Sam.
Obviously that as well.
Dr. Hansen, you wanted to jump in. And by the way, I'm going to be pressing the microphone along. I'm going to try to speak as little as possible. So, Dr. Hansen.
I guess the only thing I'd add to that is somebody who I definitely fall into more of the basic research category as opposed to a lot of people here that fall more in an applied research category. And especially, I can't really speak to other institutions, but NSF in particular in the last couple of years has really pushed for emphasizing the broader impacts and what kind of applied fields might your research lead to. What are people outside of your little piece of the pie going to have interest in this for? You know, why would anybody else care about this? And that can be a tough thing to sell if you're doing basic research sometimes. And so kind of coming at it from the other side, I mean, I have definitely noticed it's getting a lot harder. You've got to work a lot harder to make that sell and to get that money. And there are aspects, I mean, I work for the Polar Program significantly in the last few years. If we don't have this money, we don't have a program. And the last government shutdown that happened, I mean, there was serious consequences from that. And there was a lot of concern that we were not going to be able to run the Antarctic science program this year. And that was a big problem for a lot of people.
I just want to maybe say one more point about what Sam just mentioned about, you know, now that it's more competitive, are our grants getting more focused to more applied questions and that sort of thing? And my experience has been that's not the case. I think the grants are not improving because it's more competitive. People are just writing more of them. And the feeling, at least that my colleagues and I often have, is that it's very hard for a reviewer to distinguish the top four grants from the top two grants, but only the top two will be funded. And so really the people who should be spending time mentoring students or working with colleagues are instead just spending time writing grants for every possible submission date there is. And the grants, I don't think, are getting better because of the higher competition. It's just more time.
Can you quantify how much more time all of you are spending writing grants these days as you were compared to 5 years ago?
Well, none of us had jobs fighting.
Oh, fair enough. but 5 months ago?
I think that the concept of submitting a grant at the NIH, which is where my work is funded, there are three cycles a year, three opportunities, and the concept of submitting a grant at every single cycle is something I had never heard of until about a year ago, that's what people's lives were like.
Dr. Dr. Dry, could you chime in?
Yeah, I want to add another perspective. I agree about the limitations that insufficient funds cause. Another problem I see is that the planning that you make according to the duration of single PI programs and according to the lifetime of a PhD program, they don't really match. Usually single PI projects last for 2 to 3 years, where a PhD student usually takes 5 to 6 years. And this way, this kind of uncertainty definitely impacts the kind of planning you want to do, especially if you want to do really transformative research where you have to do long-term planning for the next big thing in the next 20, 30 years.
Yeah, so I completely agree. And I think, you know, to kind of bring this all together, we've seen in our basic science programs a need to articulate much more rigorous and detailed milestones and deliverables and things that we didn't have to do even when I started, back in the old days, you know, when I started, right, you know, not that many years ago. And I think these are coming not from the program managers at the lowest level who are dealing with the scientific program, but from above, you know, the need to kind of justify every single dollar that's being spent, that this is going to be what output is from this program. And it really drives a huge amount of time investment at our end to try to articulate the best and most succinct and clearly stated goals. And that's useful at some level, but we are spending so much more time on these things.
Dr. Ray, you were born in Bogota,
sure.
And you came to the United States to do your research. Could you talk about if you would make that same choice today?
Well, definitely. Well, unfortunately, in Bogota, the research possibilities are very reduced. So, well.
So America is still a good place to do research. But what about other countries? Would you be enticed to go to Japan or
I have been really lucky also because I feel partially shielded by this, by being a joint investigator, maybe also because being a woman, I don't know, I have been very protected against these cuts, but I have been part of NSF panels, and there in this NSF panel it's clear that the number of grants that is funding, NSF have been flat funded in the last couple of years, so the number of grants that has been approved are reduced, or if the same number, they reduce the budget substantially. So the problem is that you might get a grant, but if you are not able to have enough money to support a graduate student, then you don't know what to do, because you get the grant, but it's only going to support one third of your graduate student, then it's not going to be good. Also, well, DARPA, for example, we had